evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, May 17, 2017. Rights advocates wonder why Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir has been invited to a summit in Saudi Arabia while facing war crimes.
To the extent that Bashir can travel without problem, it weakens the ICC, and so Trump is contributing to that with his presence.
And an activist in the United States starts a petition drive urging the U.S. to intervene in South Sudan.
If you are a president, you have a role of bringing peace to the people. How many times President Kiir has made a presidential decree on television, relieving and appointing and relieving and appointing? He had the same power that, you know, appointing television and making a decree and to bring the peace in the country.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Analysts and rights advocates say they are concerned about reports that Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been invited to a summit this weekend in Saudi Arabia, which U.S. President Donald Trump also expects to attend. President Bashir is still wanted by the International Criminal Court for genocide and war crime charges, which were first brought by the ICC in 2009. VOA's Jill Craig reports from Nairobi.
The International Criminal Court considers Omar al-Bashir a fugitive from justice and has sought his arrest since 2009. Elise Kepler, an associate director at Human Rights Watch, says interactions between a U.S. president and an alleged war criminal would send what she calls a terrible signal.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been charged by the International Criminal Court with the most grave crimes under international law, for alleged responsibility for abuses in Darfur. The charges are genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. There really is nothing more serious.
Eric Reeves, senior fellow at Harvard University's FXB Center for Health and Human Rights, says Trump should boycott the event altogether.
To the extent that Bashir can travel without problem, it weakens the ICC, and so Trump is contributing to that with his presence.
Calls to Sudan's foreign minister and government spokesman for response went unanswered. David Bosco is an associate professor at Indiana University and an expert on the International Criminal Court. He says Saudi Arabia has welcomed Bashir in the past.
So this isn't a departure from Saudi policy on Bashir, but it is, of course, notable that he's being invited to a kind of summit where President Trump would be present. And U.S. officials have not met with Bashir, and they've had a policy of avoiding meeting with Bashir. And so Saudi Arabia's put the United States in a difficult position here.
Bosco adds that the Trump administration's position toward the ICC is still vague.
It is important to recognize that we're in a different world with the Trump administration regarding the ICC than we were with the Obama administration. The Obama administration, while, you know, it wasn't going to push to join the court, was fairly friendly toward it. The Trump administration, it's much less clear, you know, how friendly this administration is going to be to the court.
The United States is not a member of the ICC, but a State Department official provided a statement that the U.S. opposes invitations, facilitation, or support for travel by any person subject to outstanding ICC arrest warrants, including President Bashir. The U.S. lifted some sanctions against Sudan in January, with then-President Barack Obama citing positive actions by the Sudanese government. A State Department official said there could be a permanent revocation of sanctions in 6 months if progress continued. Since his indictment, Bashir has traveled to ICC member countries such as South Africa and Jordan, which have a legal obligation to arrest him, but so far have not. Because Saudi Arabia is not a member of the ICC, the country does not have the same obligation. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Some news just in. A State Department official says the U.S. opposes invitations, facilitation, or support for travel by any person subject to outstanding ICC arrest warrants, including President Bashir. A member of a civil society group calling itself Concerned Citizens of South Sudan, which is based in Salt Lake City in Utah, has started an online petition known as Save South Sudan. Jong Kur Kwat Mayol says he wants the Trump administration to intervene and find a solution to the conflict in South Sudan. Kwat says the political situation in Juba is what he calls very volatile.
President Kiir and his government, for so long, he has been using some strategy of dividing and rules. And it's something that, you know what, we should realize of people of South Sudan. We don't want to go that path because people have been affected in many ways.
You're making a very strong accusation here that President Kiir is dividing and ruling people. That's a very strong accusation. Do you have any evidence of that?
Of course. And I'm speaking here, you know, from what had happened, actually. I'm not just making any just such a accusation. Because if you realize, look what happened in Rumbek, you know, in many years back.
Which year? Which year specifically? Tell us which year.
In 2013, when he fired elected government, Tong Chulmayai, and he appointed...
You mean elected governor? I mean elected governor?
Yeah, Chul Tong Mayai was elected government in 2010. You know, he fired that governor, and he appointed Matur Shoot. And that's caused sense of division within the Rumbek community, even in central Equatoria. When he rigged the election, you know, on the expenses of Alfred Ladogore, and he appointed Kelemen Wani, it caused destruction.
When you are saying that elections were rigged in favor of candidates who are close allies of President Kiir, is there any documented evidence that these elections were rigged in favor of these candidates?
Well, how are you going to get the LA, a document to present this? Because the winner was Dawa Turjong, but President Kiir did this in favor of Malong because Malong is sued by him during when Kiir has issue with Dr. John Garang. And you remember the conference that took place in Ye when they did reconcile, you know, after the signing CPA in 2005. This transition, a problem, is going to explode again in northern Barkazal. Now we have Malwal West and we have Malwal East. They are likely to have issue because of what? Because of what Kiir has created.
Why should it be a problem when somebody is changed from one position to another in the government? I mean, these positions are not there for life. If you are appointed today to be in the government, you're not supposed to serve until you die.
The reason I'm saying that it will cause problem also, John, because you know the history, you know what happened in South Sudan. Those elites are likely to use, you know, the ordinary citizen because literacy is very high in South Sudan in our population. So Malong is likely to go there and, you know, and mobilize people and saying that, hey, our area has been ignored and so on. And this is what some, you know, politician and some, you know, army general, they have been using for the long run. If someone got, you know, relieved or got fired, he will go and mobilize community and come and fight.
Someone listening to our interview with you now, since we started, someone can easily conclude that you sound like you are just against the government. You don't like what the government is doing. What would be your response to that person?
Listen, I speak the truth. It's not just being against the government or against the rebel. I condemn both because of such a violence, because I am a non-violent, you know, advocate. President Kiir is the president of the country, okay? And the government, if you are a president, you have a role. You have a role of caring. You have a role of bringing peace to the people. How many times President Kiir has made a presidential decree into television, relieving and appointing and relieving and appointing? He had the same power that, you know, going to television and making a decree, okay, and to bring the peace in the country. Alliances are the only thing that's going on right now in North Makassar, especially if you are not an SPLM, you know, member. It means that you are against, you know, entire country. People now don't differentiate between the SPLM party and the country of South Sudan.
And what is the civil society groups like yours doing to educate the people of South Sudan that there is a difference between party and country?
Well, we are trying our best. We are trying our best to influence.
But you are very far from the people who are really facing these issues. You are in the United States of America. How are you going to educate them?
Well, we are working hard, but at least, you know, peace and stability come to the country. Because now if I go to South Sudan and I start advocating and I start speaking up about the transparency and accountability, do you think I will be safe? Do you think I will not be gunned down by a non-gunman that has been created by the regime? And it sounds like I am against the government, but this is the truth, and the truth must be said. And you know how many people have been thrown in jail. You know how many people you know have been gunned down by unknown gunmen. There is nothing say such unknown gunmen.
That's John Kurkwat Mayol, a civil society activist with the group Concerned Citizens of South Sudan. Kurkwat has started an online petition known as Save South Sudan. So far, 81 people have signed the petition. He was speaking to me from Utah earlier today. A local leader in Uganda's Adjumani district, which hosts tens of thousands of South Sudanese refugees, say the presence of so many refugees on their land has brought his people more problems than benefits. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from Adjumani district in northern Uganda.
Gray Henry Dralimo, chairman of the JP sub-county local government, which sits in the middle of four settlements that host nearly 100,000 refugees, says his troubles began when the UN Refugee Agency and the Ugandan government violated terms of agreements signed with the communities hosting the refugees. Under those agreements, Dralimo says the UNHCR and the Refugee Office of the National Government, called OPM, vowed to construct houses for community leaders, offer jobs to members of host communities, grant scholarships to their children, and upgrade basic services. Dralimo says none of that has happened.
All these agreements up to today, OPM, they are not implemented. That's why even right now, as I talk, the host community landlords, they are bitter for what was been taking place. There is no coexistence among from the refugees and the host communities.
UNHCR spokesman in Kampala, Roko Nuri, says his agency does not negotiate with host communities regarding provision of land for refugees. He says there is no direct trade-off, such as providing free land or offering assistance packages for children of community leaders. He says local communities benefit from investments made by humanitarian and development agencies in education, healthcare, and other job opportunities. Dralimo does not see it that way.
The way how those people they were being recruiting, they don't want to recruit our landlords, Osti district, general. The youth, they are bitter about of that. Recently, even they are about to do a demonstration.
Dralimo says the large influx of refugees has increased traffic on the roads, leaving many roads damaged, and it's been bad for the environment because refugees use up Uganda's natural resources to build houses. Dralimo also claims some refugees came with cattle, which have destroyed crops.
Trees, they're all destroyed. Grass, even our soil. Water shortages, or food shortages. Because when your food was being stolen, there is insecurity.
Dralimo says the working relationship between organizations operating in the refugee settlements and local authorities is not good.
Even among from these implementing agents, there is no cooperation. You will get all these NGOs, their activities within in your jurisdiction areas. You cannot even understand as a leader, as a sub-county stakeholders, as a district. When now they have got a problem there, they will rush to the authority of the sub-county, especially to me. I told them, I'm not a doctor who can do post-mortem.
Nuri insists there is strong coordination between UNHCR and the Ugandan government at the local government level, but did not say if the coordination extends to sub-county officials. Dralimo says local leaders in the ZIP area have decided that if the national government and the UNHCR are unwilling to implement their part of the deal with the communities hosting refugees, the UNHCR should be asked to pay rent for the land where they settled refugees.
Out of that district and sub-county, they will benefit there with the dirty renting money, because we can get even our percentage from there, taxing.
Dralimo says local leaders are considering sending the UNHCR an ultimatum to either honor their agreement or relocate the refugees. Nuri says his agency appreciates the role that host communities play in providing land to refugees. He also says the international community must provide the necessary support to ease pressure on local service delivery and build infrastructure for the fast growing population. The refugee office of the Ugandan government did not respond to several requests for reaction to this story. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, malaria cases are on the rise in Yei River State. Find out what is being done and where when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Tell me about something beautiful that moved you recently.
A cousin of mine gave birth after a long period of trying to have a baby. It took them about 6 years to have their first baby.
The most beautiful thing that moves me recently is the roads and also the lights and also the happiness of my family.
Oh yeah, I have a lot, but what I can say is education. I've just pursued my degree and it's really doing me well because I've already got a job that can earn me and then improve my life.
Something that moved me recently is that I was given a responsibility to head a big project, first of its kind in my life. So it's something that was great.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Congressional Caucus on Sudan and South Sudan, a bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers, is urging the Treasury Department to use its full range of financial tools to target corruption and what it calls kleptocratic networks at the core of South Sudan's civil war. Ian Schwab, Director of Advocacy and Impact Strategy for the U.S.-based Enough Project, tells INBO that Treasury officials could put into play money laundering tools that would hold leaders from Sudan and South Sudan accountable.
Treasury investigates and can also enforce instances of money laundering. They can also investigate various individuals as well as the networks and enablers around various individuals. So if there was a sanction put forward, that they would be able to actually enforce the sanctions. One of the issues that we've seen in the past is not simply the fact that there has not been a robust enough number of individuals and their networks that have been put onto sanctions lists, but also that the necessary investigations and enforcement of sanctions needs to happen or else the designation will be meaningless.
There seems to be strong bipartisan support from Congress when it comes to South Sudan. Leaders from both sides are keen on stepping in to try to help South Sudanese. But yet it seems like progress is slow. Is that an appropriate assessment?
It's fair to say that there is a bipartisan consensus that what's happening in South Sudan is unacceptable, inhumane. There's a distinct interest in ensuring that the conflict stops, that famine is addressed, and I think Congress is trying to spur action and trying to demonstrate that there's a number of things that can actually be done that aren't being done. Sometimes in these types of situations where conflict has been ongoing for many years, there becomes a feeling that, well, what more can we do? And I think that this letter from Treasury distinctly shows that there's a lot more that can be done, and Congress is trying to press to ensure those things happen, in this case, directed at Treasury.
And how much power does the Treasury Department have? In other words, how much could they do on their own, and then how much permission would they need from the White House to sort of enact, these tools that you've mentioned?
The Department in general does have a lot of power to work to ensure that there isn't corrupt money in the U.S. that is touching the U.S. financial system. They have a lot of ability to work with banks and other similar agencies in, for example, in governments in the region. So there's a lot that Treasury can do. Obviously, whatever Treasury is going to do needs to be part of a larger strategy in terms of U.S. policy towards South Sudan. So you need both. You need a larger strategy set by the policymakers, and then you need the Treasury Department and their various units to be doing the investigations and enforcement that's needed to use these financial tools.
That's Enough Projects. Ian Schwab speaking to Ian Buehr from Washington. Today is International Technology Day, a day to create global awareness about societal changes made possible by the Internet. It also aims to help reduce the digital divide around the world. A USAID-funded non-governmental organization is helping some South Sudanese create awareness about new technology that makes the Internet more accessible in countries like South Sudan. Mungume Debs Rakarinj has more for VOA from Kigali.
Dozens of people fill a room at the Women Union's computer lab in Juba's Hainim neighborhood. The lab is part of a program called Systems to Uphold Credibility and Constitutionality of Elections in South Sudan, or SUCCESS, which is funded by the US-based NGO Democracy International. This year's theme is Big Data for Big Impact, highlighting what the Internet can do to boost development. Cesar Uludi is manager of the Women Union's computer lab in Juba.
Where information is available for the citizens, they'll be able to think positively. And here we are really trying to change that idea of, like, people can't afford newspapers, people can't listen to radios, but if they find themselves here, they read news from here, they access any other document from here.
Uludi says at least 100 people get to access the Internet free of charge from the lab every day. Jane Gordon-Soro, who works with the South Sudan Women Entrepreneurs Association, says the Internet can be expensive to access in cybercafes, so she appreciates the lab.
We access the email from here. Here we can get our access to proposal call from the Internet, through the Internet, and then we also submit our proposal and reports through this Internet. It is very important, and it is very successful for us as an organization.
She says she will advise fellow women entrepreneurs hop on the Internet at the lab to advertise their products, check email, or find out what is happening on social media. Hakim Francis is a 29-year-old final year accounting student at Uganda's Kumba University. He says he's able to come do research for his thesis from this lab.
Well, when I go out to the Internet cafe, usually they charge about 60 to 80 pounds per hour, and it is expensive to some of us who are students who will not be able to afford that money. And when you also use a telephone, you find that may not be helpful for long because the telephone is not like a computer.
Student and businessman Sami Hajjaj also benefits from using the lab. Hajjaj deals in designer sports clothes and says he relies on the Internet to connect him to the world.
Actually, I come and I search what I want, and actually it helps me, it gives me idea about how to expand my business and also to get experience from outside people who actually gone far in this field. So I get more information through Internet. I order products sometime here.
Hajjaj says he's able to pay his school fees at the University of Juba and buy scholastic materials from the money he earns from his online business. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Kigali, Rwanda.
Yei County health officials say the number of malaria cases has shot up in recent weeks. The Yei County Health Director says doctors have diagnosed thousands of people with malaria this past month, and most of them are women and children. Daniel Friday Martin has this report for VOA from Yei Town.
A child at Yei Civil Hospital cries out in pain as he is injected with medication to fight malaria. In the next bed, Agnes Kongole nurses her 3-year-old daughter, Mary Dusman, who also suffers from malaria. Speaking in Arabic, Congolese says her daughter has been treated at the hospital for the last 4 days and is feeling better.
My child went to school and fell sick with malaria while at school. I was called and brought her to the hospital. She was found with malaria and the doctors admitted her. And currently, I have seen that she is getting better.
Michael Lugala, director of the health department at Ye River County, says medical workers at Ye Civil Hospital have recorded more than 2,000 cases of malaria in the last 3 weeks alone.
The alarming thing is that, you know, cases of malaria is very, very high. Like we have children recorded 853 and one dead. And adult, we have 1,573. With no death recorded. In a total, we have 2,426. So this is a big number.
Lugala says one patient recently died of malaria at the hospital. Alice Nyoka looks after her two children, both of whom were diagnosed with malaria and have been admitted to the hospital. Speaking in Arabic, Nyoka describes what her children have been going through.
The other one has 5 years, while the other with 1 year and 4 months. They have high body temperature, headache, and vomiting. I rushed them to the hospital, and the doctors gave them some injection, and their bodies are now okay.
Yes, Civil Hospital Medical Director Dr. James Wani says the number of malaria cases is increasing because the current heavy rains are favorable for breeding mosquitoes, which carry malaria parasites. On top of that, Wani says many area residents are bitten by mosquitoes because they do not sleep under nets. He describes the current outbreak as epidemic.
Mostly we receive the patients from the pediatrics, from the children's ward and maternity site, pregnant women. And it is endemic because of the rainy season. But because the number of cases increases, the drugs finish quickly, no malaria.
Due to the shortage of drugs, doctors refer some malaria patients to private pharmacies in the town. One of those patients is Selwa Nancy, who says she has no money to buy anti-malaria drugs.
I was found of malaria, so they sent me to a clinic that I have to go and buy medicine, and yet I have nothing. Now I'm confused. I don't know what I can do.
Both the UN's World Health Organization and the South Sudan Health Ministry acknowledge that malaria remains a major health concern across the country. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday-Martin in Yei.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Abie Apin by Abie Jazz Band.
Abie, 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 Abie. Abie, oh, Abie, Apin, Deng, Tiam, Da, Kwa. Abie, Deng, Tiam, Da, Kwa. Pinde, oh, Abie, Bangalore, Abie. Inchu, Kamilip, Kuleli, Nikok. Kuleli kalam wachini jabiai bangalai abiai abin deng tiam da kwa abin deng tiam da kwa.
Been listening to a test of a song from Abie Jazz Band with the song Abie Apin. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Bandidi ngak abuga ta yang pameo kiti diriot bandidi ngak.